Okay, so welcome back again. So we're going to continue on with the last few sutras. The next one on the list here is called Nibbana. Exciting name. So we're getting close now to the kind of the end of the path and many of these things. This is just another way of looking at the path that I'm going to have a look at, a kind of very simple way of thinking about the Buddhist path as a whole. And as such, it actually is quite useful and quite nice. It summarizes, in a sense, many of the things that we've been talking about, and kind of makes it into a simple, kind of simple concept, simple idea of how the path actually works. So this is how this sutta goes. Then the Venerable Ananda approached the Venerable Sariputta and said to him, "Why is it, friend Sariputta, that some beings do not attain Nibbana in this very life? Here, friend Ananda, some beings do not understand as it really is. These perceptions lead to deterioration. These perceptions lead to stability. These perceptions lead to improvement or distinction. These perceptions lead to penetration. This is why some beings here do not attain Nibbana in this very life." And why is it, friend Sariputta, that some beings here do attain Nibbana in this very life? Here, friend Ananda, some beings do understand as it really is. These perceptions lead to deterioration. These perceptions lead to stability. These perceptions lead to distinction or improvement. These perceptions lead to penetration. This is why some beings here attain Nibbana in this very life. Very simple, right? This is kind of, in a way, this can be regarded as a summary of the whole path to awakening, to Nibbana, this little summary here. And it's all about understanding what leads to Nibbana and what doesn't. Because if you don't understand, then of course you can't even practice it. If you don't really know what's going on, you can't move in that direction. So all you have to do is know these things are part of the path, these things are not. Right? And when you do that, you have a choice. You can choose those perceptions that are useful, that lead in the right direction, and you can reject those ones that are not useful, that lead away from the goal. So if you understand that something is a deteriorating perception that leads to bad states, then of course straight away you change it to another one. Perceptions that lead to stability can sometimes be useful, right? When you're in a jhana state or you want to stabilize, you're learning about something, you want to stabilize a certain thing like a nimitta or the watching the breath or something like that. Sometimes these things can be good. In the long run, you want to improve things, and eventually you want to kind of make a breakthrough through the Dhamma, to penetrate the Dhamma itself. Very simple and easy way of understanding the Buddhist path. And it means that at any time in life, during your whole day, if you keep on choosing the right perception, the perception that leads onward, that leads forward, that leads to decline in unwholesome qualities and an increasing in wholesome qualities, if you have this at the back of your mind all the time, and you always practice this, it's pretty hard to do it all the time actually, but you know, you kind of do the best you can, then you are heading in the right direction. Of course, it means you have to understand the perceptions. So this is a big part of the Buddhist practice, is to understand which ones are the good ones and which ones are the bad ones. And these are many of the things that we have been talking about during this retreat, right? So you know what you're supposed to look out for and what not. So there you are. It's a simple way of thinking about the Buddhist path. And I will just move straight on to the next sutta. This is the Sakkapanya Sutta, Sakka's questions. Sakka is the kind of chief heavenly being in the heaven called the heaven of the 33, the Tavatimsa heaven, according to kind of the Buddhist structure of the cosmos, if you like. And I mentioned him a few days ago. We're talking about I was talking about kind of this heavenly musician playing a love song to the Buddha, and this was this occasion, this particular sutta actually. That's when that happened. So, and Sakka, when he, in this particular sutta, he comes down to the Buddha, he asks all these questions. And these questions are actually very good. The core part of the sutta are actually quite interesting and nice, even though some of the things on the outside are a bit stranger. And at the end of that sutta, the Sakka, the boss, right, the main god, the head honcho in the Tavatengsa heaven, he becomes a stream enterer here. Right? So this is the fellow who runs the whole heavenly realm. He's a stream enterer here. It's kind of nice to think of. You have the ruler of the whole realm is a stream enterer here. It's quite useful when you have that. When the leaders in society are, you know, have an understanding of Dhamma, everything becomes much more pleasant, I suspect. So it's quite nice little sutta about that. And also he has all these penetrative questions that he asks the Buddha at the time. And this is one of those questions, and it kind of expands a little bit on what we have seen in the previous sutta. So, on one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling at Rajagaha, on Mount Vulture Peak, the Gijakuta. You can go there today and see the Vulture Peak even at the present day. Then Sakka, Lord of the Devas, approached the Blessed One, paid homage to him, and said to him, that's interesting. Okay, I see. Yeah, this is not that sutta. Okay, yeah. Okay, anyway. Venerable Sir, what is the cause and reason why some beings here do not attain Nibbana in this life? And what is the cause and reason why some beings here do attain Nibbana in this very life? There are, Lord of the Devas, forms cognizable by the eye that are desirable, lovable or lovely, agreeable, pleasing, sensually enticing and tantalizing. If a bhikkhu seeks delight in them, welcomes them, and remains holding to them, his consciousness becomes dependent upon them and clings to them. A bhikkhu with clinging does not attain Nibbana. Right, so very, very simple. And here, this relates straight away to the previous one, because it depends on how we perceive these forms, right? The perception is a crucial issue here. You can perceive them in one way, and if you can perceive them in one way, they become desirable, lovely, agreeable, pleasing, sensual, enticing, tantalizing, welcome, wonderful forms, and you delight in them, you welcome them, you hold on to them, and then, as we have seen in the whole sequence of dependent arising, your consciousness gets established there, established at that level, it holds on at that level, and it kind of moves on in accordance with that. And then there is no Nibbana, right? Because you keep on getting reborn, your consciousness is stuck at that level, essentially. And it is always pointing in that direction towards sensual desire, always aiming for that, always having that as its purpose in life. This is what happens as a consequence of seeing this. So this tells you that perception is really the underlying problem here, because it is how you look at those forms that decides how you then react as a consequence. Are they desirable, or are they something that you want to abandon desire for instead? Perception is the only difference here, the only thing that makes that difference. Yes. And also interesting, of course, because in the previous sutta, the Buddha just says that, talks about perceptions in a very general way. These perceptions lead to deterioration, etc. And here he picks out one perception in particular, which leads to Nibbana and which just does not lead to Nibbana. So obviously, this whole area of sensual desire, of clinging to sensual things, is crucial, right? It's one of the critical areas of whether you're going to attain Nibbana or not. It's a critical for whether you're going to be able to attain Samadhi, and then eventually also whether you're going to go all the way to Nibbana, to extinguishment itself. So it is a critical, and of course quite difficult to deal with, basically. That's probably the reality. Hard to change our habits in this area. There are, Lord of the Devas, sounds cognizable by the ear. Then you have odors cognizable by the nose, taste cognizable by the tongue, tangibles cognizable by the body, mental phenomena cognizable by the mind, that are desirable, lovely, agreeable, pleasing, sensually enticing, tantalizing. If anyone, not just the bhikkhu, but anyone seeks delight in them, welcomes them, and remains holding to them, his consciousness becomes dependent upon them and clings to them. A bhikkhu with clinging does not attain Nibbana. So same thing again, any sensual object, anything which belongs to the karma loka, even the mental phenomena, right? You think about something which is within that realm, same problem again. This is the cause and reason, Lord of the Devas, why some beings here do not attain Nibbana in this very life. There are, Lord of the Devas, forms cognizable by the eye, mental phenomena, etc., etc., mental phenomena cognizable by the mind that are desirable, lovely, agreeable, pleasing, sensually enticing, tantalizing. If a bhikkhu does not seek delight in them, does not welcome them, and does not remain holding to them, his consciousness does not become dependent upon them or cling to them. A bhikkhu without clinging attains Nibbana. This is the cause and reason, Lord of the Devas, why some beings here attain Nibbana in this very life. It's interesting here, isn't it? He talks about a monk without clinging attains Nibbana, and the only clinging that he is really concerned about here is the clinging in the sensual realm. Often we think about clinging as much broader than that, clinging to existence itself, maybe clinging to the higher states of meditation, all of these things. But here he's talking specifically about the clinging in the sensual realm. Now part of that might be because he's talking to the head of the gods, right? Of course, in the heavenly realm, one of the reasons you get reborn in particularly these realms is precisely because you enjoy sensual pleasures. That's why you get reborn there. So presumably Sakka is kind of addicted to sensual pleasures, so he has to remind him of this. And there is in fact a sutta elsewhere where Mahamoggallana, this is according to the sutta, I don't know exactly whether this is a historical fact or not, but Mahamoggallana goes up to the heavenly realms and he has a conversation with Sakka, and he says to Sakka, he says this verse out, or this little statement of the Dhamma about not holding to things or clinging to things. And someone who doesn't do that, they attain Nibbana. They become non-agitated and eventually attain Nibbana. And Sakka says, yeah, I know about all that, right? It looks like he's not really all that interested. You know, we are very busy in heaven. We have to build palaces and all this kind of stuff, you know. Heavenly realm, very busy, very busy realm. That's basically what he says. And then Mahamoggallana thinks, oh, this spirit, he calls Sakka a spirit. This spirit is far too negligent. So he kind of says, he goes to Sakka over to see this palace that he's building, right? And he kind of, Sakka shows him around this marvelous palace with 700 towers and this kind of astonishing palace, kind of unimaginable in the human realm. And then Mahamoggallana goes over to this enormous palace and he touches the palace with his big toe. And as it does so, the whole palace starts to shake and quiver. And Sakka goes, ooh, what's going on there? Sakka gets a bit of a fright, right? This beautiful palace of his is shaking and quivering. And then when he kind of regains his mindfulness, then Mahamoggallana asks him again about this verse. And then he says, well, actually, I do remember that verse because I learned it myself in the presence of the Buddha, perhaps when he visited him at this occasion or something like that. That's a little bit of the story of Sakka, but obviously you can see he was attached to sensuality. This may be one of the reasons. But another reason why the Buddha emphasizes sensuality here is that this is the main issue, right? Once you get past sensuality, past the attraction to the body, and you enter those very profound states of samadhi, then basically most of the work is done already. You look at the Noble Eightfold Path, what is the last step on the Noble Eightfold Path? Samma Samadhi, the jhanas. Right? That's the last step. It's one of those strange things for people. What about Nibbana? Where's Nibbana here? This ends with Samma Samadhi. And of course the point is that once you get to that point, you have done the fair share of the work. There isn't much more to do. Now you can kind of just chill, right? You know, enjoying the jhanas, and the more you enjoy the jhanas by just kind of sitting there doing nothing, the less you do, the more you just enjoy yourself, the more insight you have. So it's pretty automatic at that point. All you have to do is to enjoy those states of samadhi, and eventually you get there. So the hard part of the path, the clinging which is difficult, which is problematic, is this one here. And if you bring your right view, your right understanding of existence, of reality, if you bring that with you into your samadhi practice, then that right view together with the samadhi, they will kind of make the explosion. It's like the oxygen and the match coming together, and bang, the whole thing goes bang, and then you see the world in a different way, and you think, wow, this is really good, isn't it? And then you are very happy as a consequence. So this is that sutta, and it shows you again the importance of this this particular thing, and the idea of how we have to learn to change our perceptions about this, and how difficult it can be. As long as you have attachment, as long as you have desires, it actually is quite hard. So we have to kind of learn it step by step, gradually, and then this gradual abandoning until eventually you get to that point. Okay, so next sutta I'm going to have a look at is called the Giri Mananda Sutta. And this sutta is a sutta about 10 kinds of perceptions. So we are staying with the theme of perceptions. And if the Buddha has said that perceptions, or the Buddha has also said it somewhere, that perceptions can take you all the way to Nibbana, then it's worthwhile looking at, right? So what are these perceptions that can take us all the way to Nibbana? And these 10 are, found here in the Giri Mananda Sutta are almost like a summary of the perceptions that you find throughout the suttas. There are some strange ones in here as well, but essentially they are a summary of what is found in the suttas elsewhere. The Giri Mananda Sutta is considered a paritta in Sri Lanka. So in Sri Lanka, or actually I think all Theravada countries really, is it paritta? Also in Tibet is considered a paritta. That was a sutta that was transmitted directly from Sri Lanka to Tibet in the, I think, 14th century, this Giri Mananda Sutta. So it exists in Tibetan translation, but not an ancient Tibetan translation. It's a fairly recent one. There was a Sri Lankan monk called Ananda Siri or something who went to Tibet at that time and helped translate that sutta into Tibetan. So the Tibetan canon is a bit of a mixture of things. It has, you know, recent translations, ancient translations, a bit of Theravada, a bit of this, a bit of that. So it's kind of a very complicated canonical texts in the Tibetan tradition here. So this is often used as a paritta. Paritta means like a blessing chant, right? To kind of help you ward off anything dangerous. But that is what this is used. It's one of those strange things that in the suttas too, you might think that this sounds very superstitious, right? Okay, you do a chant and then everything is fine afterwards. But there are some suttas, in particular in the what is called the Bodhanga Sanyutta, the connected discourses on the factors of awakening. And there, even the Buddha says to one of the monks, please chant, please recite the Bodhangas for me, the factors of awakening. And he does, and afterwards the Buddha, he had some ailment, some illness, and afterwards he's fine. And it's kind of strange, and you wonder how this can be the case. Why didn't he just recite those factors himself, you think, right? Why does he have to hear from somebody else? What's going on there? And I don't know, actually. I have no idea what's really happening. But there are often so many strange possibilities in this world, you can't really discount them. Perhaps it is a later kind of development, I don't know. But perhaps these things actually do work. I'm not sure about this. So at the very least, as I was saying the other day, there will always be that little placebo effect there, regardless of whether the chanting has a direct effect or not. So what is it that was chanted on this occasion? And we shall now find out. On one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling at Savati in Jeta's Grove, another Pindika's park. Now, on that occasion, the Venerable Giri Mananda was sick, afflicted, and gravely ill. Then the Venerable Ananda approached the Blessed One, paid homage to him, sat down to one side, and said to him, Bhante, the Venerable Giri Mananda is sick, afflicted, and gravely ill. It would be good if the Blessed One would visit him out of compassion. Okay, so maybe this is a good time just to, for those of you who are not so familiar with the suttas perhaps, I don't know, there are probably a few here who are not so familiar. These places that we're talking about here, like Savati, etc. These were the places in ancient India where there were large monasteries and where the Buddha would normally stay. The Jeta Grove is one of those monasteries. And Jeta, he was a prince at that time. And he was a prince in this particular republic, one of the sons probably of King Pasenadi, who was a very devout disciple of the Buddha. And he gave, Prince Jeta sold this big park, if you like, to Anathapindika. Anathapindika was one of the benefactors of the Sangha and of the Buddha. So he sold it, and this, according to the story, which is probably not true at all, it's a story that was invented later on, but anyway, it's a story. He asked an exorbitant price for this park because he knew that Anathapindika was extremely wealthy. He was an extremely wealthy merchant. And he was a devout disciple of the Buddha. So he thought, this fellow, he is so devout, he'd be willing to pay anything for this park, right? They were going to really kind of extort him, extract him to the maximum. And really dodgy, these dodgy princes, you can't really, sometimes you can't trust them. So he said to Anathapindika, the only way I will sell this park to you, if you cover the whole park in pieces of gold, then I will buy you. So the whole park has to be covered. I don't want to see a straw of grass after you've covered the whole park. Yeah. So Anathapindika does that. He actually does cover the whole park with gold. And it's a large area. I mean, you've been there. It's kind of, you know, I don't know how large it is. It's very hard to know because it may have been much larger in those days. But now, how large is it? 10 acres perhaps, something like that. Maybe 20 acres. So he covered all that area with gold. And it may have been much larger in those days. And that is the story behind that. And that is where the Buddha was. That's why you have Anathapindika's park afterwards. And of course, if you travel to India today, you can see these places, right? They actually exist. They have been rediscovered in recent years. In particular, the British were very quite big in rediscovering the Buddhist holy places when they were in charge in India. So this was back in the 19th century. And there was some British archaeologists who were very famous for doing this kind of detective work of rediscovering many of these sites. So we know pretty much that these are the sites, and there are also archaeological excavations have been done to confirm that. So that I don't think there's much doubt that that is the case. So that is where the Buddha was staying, right? It looked very different, obviously, in those days. And then you had the Venerable Giri Mananda was also staying there. Giri Mananda. Giri means hill. Ananda means happiness, bliss, joy. So the happiness of the hill or something like that. I'm not sure exactly what that... Maybe Giri means something else in this connection. I'm not entirely sure. All of these names have a meaning. He was sick. And then the Venerable Ananda goes to the Buddha and says, please approach him out of compassion, to help him, right? And the idea is that if you get to see the Buddha, you may be able to get out of that illness, maybe able to make your mind more peaceful and calm, because the Buddha will give you a nice teaching which kind of makes you feel better. That's the idea. But the Buddha says the following. If Ananda, you visit the bhikkhu Giri Mananda and speak to him about 10 perceptions, it is possible that on hearing about them, his affliction will immediately subside. What are the 10? The perception of impermanence, the perception of non-self, the perception of unattractiveness, the perception of danger, the perception of abandoning, the perception of dispassion, the perception of cessation, the perception of non-delight in the entire world, the perception of impermanence in all conditioned phenomena, and last of all, mindfulness of breathing. So there you are, the 10 perceptions in brief, and many of these perceptions are very profound, as you will soon see, and they have to do with the very kind of higher aspects of the Buddhist path. So a lot of this is profound. Not everything here is profound. Some of it is more kind of down to earth and useful for everybody. But some of it is the sort of stuff you only really get into once your meditation starts to really take off. So now let us have a look at these various perceptions and see what the Buddha has to say about these things. Okay. And what, Ananda, is the perception of impermanence? Here, having gone to the forest, to the foot of a tree, or to an empty hut, a bhikkhu reflects thus. Form is impermanent. Feeling is impermanent. Perception is impermanent. Willed activities are impermanent. Consciousness is impermanent. Thus he dwells contemplating impermanence in these five aspects of personality subject to clinging. This is called the perception of impermanence. So that's what you have to do. You go back to your room, and afterwards, and you think, form is impermanent, feeling is impermanent. And then you think, how is this supposed to work? That's what you think afterwards. This is really weird. I'm sitting here reciting these things, nothing happens. How does this work? And of course, there is more to it than meets the eye here, because it is not easy to, you know, you have to actually know what's going on to be able to make headway here. I have talked about this a little bit before, but I will just repeat it now again, how this really works as far as I can see, and how it seems fairly obvious from places like the Anapanasati Sutta, how you're supposed to do these kind of reflections. And the first thing you will notice here, it says that having gone to the forest or to the foot of a tree or to an empty hut, right? So this is something that is a clue that straight away shows you profound meditation. It shows you samadhi, it shows you something profound. It's not just something you do in daily life, right, while you're washing the dishes or something. This is something you do when you're by yourself, when you're far away, when you are secluded, and when you're able to attain deep states of samadhi. Deep states of samadhi are the basis for these kind of insights. And you can see that again in the Anapanasati Sutta, where you go through all the stages of Anapanasati, you get to the jhanas, to samadhi, and then afterwards you do these kind of insight contemplations. I'm not sure if reflection is a very good word either, because a reflection sounds like you're kind of verbalizing. It's more like contemplation is closer to the truth here. To contemplate something, this means to kind of lean your mind onto it, to be aware of it. It doesn't really mean verbalizing so much, but more, this has more to do with direct seeing things as they actually are here. So what do you do? How do you do this? So you go to this empty hut, you get into you make your meditation as deep as you possibly can, and then afterwards, when you come out of that meditation afterwards, then you start to reflect, right? What was it that disappeared in this meditation? What was it that was impermanent? Remember, impermanent doesn't just mean changeability. It also means disappearance of things. It means the fading away, the gradual disappearing, and the full disappearing. It means all of these things combined. Changeability, fading away, and cessation. All of that is part of this term, anicca. So after you come out, don't do this while you are doing your breath meditation or whatever, but afterwards. And then you think, what happened during that meditation, right? You reflect back. And what you see when you contemplate that, of course, you see that your body is fading away, right? Fading away is impermanence. The body is becoming less of it until gradually it disappears altogether. It ceases. And that is the whole sequence of impermanence. First of all, you can see how the body is always changing, of course. That's a very kind of coarse level of seeing impermanence. Then you can see how the body fades away gradually. There's less and less of it until there's only the breath left, right? And the rest of the body is pretty much gone. And eventually it all ceases. When you enter into jhana, it's completely gone. There's no access is possible to the body anymore. And this is how you contemplate impermanence. You see the gradual disappearance of this as you go through this. This also includes the senses, because the senses are also part of the body. The senses are contemplated just below in more detail, but it's also part of this one as well. You see the senses also fading away, right? They are impermanent, first of all, always changing, then fading away, becoming fainter and fainter and fainter, until eventually they turn off completely, and all you're left with is a blissful feeling in the mind. That's all you have left. And there's no access anymore to those senses at all. So this is what you see, this is what you reflect on, this is how you do impermanence. It's based on a real experience. It's not just reflecting kind of theoretically or intellectually, it's based on what you actually have seen for yourself. And then it starts to become powerful. You can tell that because of that initial phrase there about meditation. And then you have feelings, right? Feelings are impermanent. Same kind of things. There are feelings because the feelings are often related to other aspects of your existence. So if the body is there, then when the body is gone, all bodily feeling have disappeared, right? It's very obvious. But not just that, there are feelings that are associated with the senses. Feelings are, you know, these are called the amisa happiness. Amisa means literally, or samisa means literally like the carnal or, you know, the kind of the physical, if you want, feelings. And then you have the niramisa sukha, which means the non-carnal or the spiritual happiness. So you see the physical feelings, the carnal feelings. Carnal is a kind of this Christian word, which is kind of used sometimes in Christianity. That's why I don't really like it all that much, but it kind of makes the point. Carnal means meat, right? So of the flesh, quite literally. Quite the happiness of the flesh, if you like. So those feelings disappear. They're all gone until you have the niramisa sukha, the sukha of the spiritual happiness of samadhi arises instead. As one goes down, the other one goes up, right? So you have the dispassion or the gradual decreasing of one and the increase of the other one. Feelings are changing. Then you have the piti sukha. We talk about the piti sukha arising, right, in meditation. So you have the feelings of piti, the feelings of sukha gradually coming to the coming up, and then they disappear as well. Certain aspects of them disappear, and you see this happening as you go through this process. They become more refined as you approach jhana. The coarser aspect disappear, and you see this process, and you see certain feelings being again impermanent, being subject to fading away and ceasing. You see this as you go through this whole process, and then you start to understand the impermanence of these things. So in a sense here, there is like the form disappears and the feelings that are connected with the form also disappear. So they reinforce each other. It makes it stronger and more clear what is happening here. Then you have perceptions, right? Again, very closely related to the previous ones. Your perception of the world is changing as you go through this. You are seeing different things. You are no longer have any perception of the body that disappears. You can see very closely related to the previous ones. And your perceptions are changing. You're having more bliss. You're having a very simplified view of reality. Eventually you get to the samadhinimittas and all you have is this bright light in the mind. That's all you have. Everything else is gone, right? A very simple perception. And everything else has pretty much faded away. There's a change in perception, a change in what you are, what is available to you in your mental landscape, if you like. Then you have volitional formation. This is a little bit different. The other three are very closely related to each other, but volitional formations or willed activities is different. So this is the movement of the mind, the mind's activities, the thing which initiates actions inside of you. What the thing which drives the bodily actions, the verbal actions, and also the mental actions themselves. This is the will inside of us. So you see how the will dies down, right, as you practice. I'm sure you have seen that to some extent already. When you become peaceful, one of the reasons why you become peaceful in your meditation is because the will is dying down. It doesn't produce any thinking anymore. It doesn't produce all this movement inside. And you know how nice that is, right? It's just so nice when things become peaceful. You think, wow, all that activity, all that thinking is dying down. And this is so nice. So you contemplate that. You see how the volition becomes less and less, the more peaceful you become, the less things there are is going on there, until you enter the jhanas and there's no volition at all anymore. There's no access. You can't do anything. There's no access to the doing capability of the mind. That has all disappeared, all gone out completely. So volitions are impermanent. And lo and behold, you are more happy without them. Right, when they're gone, you used to think, this is me, I am activity, I am the doer in the world. Wow, it is so great to be the doer in the world. And suddenly your view is turned upside down. It is so bad to be the doer in the world. How nice it is to be just peaceful and not having anything to do at all. You can see what the Buddha says, what the worldlings think are happiness, the Aryan say is suffering. What the worldling thinks is suffering, the Aryan say is happiness. It's like you've turned everything upside down almost. And this is one of those aspects you see there. The gradual elimination of willed activities happen as you go through this process. And you can see that happening here. Consciousness is impermanent. Right now, it's getting very subtle. But you can see this as well because, first of all, you can see it because the consciousness is related to the senses. So when five senses have disappeared, a large part of consciousness has gone by its already. The only consciousness left is the consciousness of the mind. But then you go beyond that, right? You think, well, you think, I've come to this is surely the end of the universe. I found absolute final bliss. Surely you can't go beyond this. But then you can actually go beyond that as well. And that is what happens then, is that your mind gets simplified. You can't become any more peaceful. You already reached the max stillness. But what you can do from this point on is simplify the mind. You can throw out chunks of the mind, right? And simplify the mind to become more and more simple. Throw out the piti, throw out the sukha. There's only upeka, equanimity left. Throw out the whole form realm. So there's only infinity of space left. Right? These are kind of states which are impossible. They are just so different from anything that one can experience in ordinary life. That, you know, it's just an infinity of space. Then you have infinity of consciousness. And you have the experience of nothingness. How can you experience nothingness? How is that possible? Well, according to the suttas, you can experience even nothingness, the experience of nothingness. There's nothing there. And then you go even beyond that. So with each of these steps, what you're doing is just simplifying consciousness. Consciousness is gradually disappearing, becoming less and less, kind of forced into a tight corner where there's almost nothing left until eventually you let go of the whole thing and it disappears. So that is the path of contemplating impermanence, seeing impermanence in the five aggregates subject to clinging here. And it is very interesting, and it is something that you can do in your meditation. You can see this already from fairly early on, how this works, right? And you will see that with every step of things fading away, disappearing, you will see that there is a degree, an increase in happiness, an increase in well-being as a consequence. And then you can see the good side of impermanence, right? The bad side of impermanence, if you cling to all the things in the world and they change. But here is the kind of the reverse. If you let go of all of those things, wow, you feel happiness instead. You feel so much joy as a consequence of that. So here is the kind of the flip side of the coin. You let go and then happiness arises. The less there is, the better you feel for it. This is called the perception of impermanence. So see if you can, after your meditation, especially if you have a good one, then reflect a little bit like this and see if you can get some feeling at the very least for where happiness lies in the world. That is perhaps the most important part. Insight into the impermanence, yes, you can get a little bit of that as well, but certainly you can come to understand where happiness lies. Okay, next perception. And what, Ananda, is the perception of non-self? Here, having gone to the forest, to the foot of a tree, or to an empty hut, a bhikkhu reflects thus. The eye is non-self. Forms are non-self. The ear is non-self. Sounds are non-self. The nose is non-self. Odors are non-self. The tongue is non-self. Taste are non-self. The body is non-self. Tactile objects are non-self. The mind is non-self, mental phenomena are non-self. Thus he dwells contemplating non-self in these six internal and external sense bases. This is called the perception of non-self. So the six internal sense bases are just the sense faculties, right? The eye itself, the sense field or sense sphere perhaps. External ones are the whole world that is available to the eye, the whole world out there of visions, etc., that is the external sense field, the whole field, the whole domain, the whole area, the whole sphere of all these things is what is meant here. And here again, you see, it starts off by going to the foot of a tree, to an empty hut. Same kind of thing again, right? So straight away we know this has to do with profound meditation. This is not something you can do in ordinary life. You have to get into some samadhi first of all, and then you can do this kind of contemplations. So here again, the same idea, very similar idea to the one we saw in the previous perception. the I being non-self and forms are non-self, right? Well, one obvious way of seeing that is that, again, you go into a meditation, deep state of samadhi, there is no I then, no seeing, it's completely gone, right? Well, if it's completely gone, you have no access to it, it means it's non-self, you have no control over it. One of the definitions of having a self is that you have control over something. If something has gone outside of your control, it means it can't have anything to do with yourself. And in this case, it has gone outside of your control because you can't access these things if the samadhi is deep enough. And then you think, oh, the I is non-self. Very interesting. Forms are non-self, right? Because that obviously goes together with the I. So in this way, you can start to uncover that this non-self feeling here. Gradually, when things are disappearing, things are falling away, there's less and less there. So all the six senses gradually disappear, right? Eventually the sounds also disappear completely. Then you can see the impermanence of all that. And of course, the last thing to be present is the mind itself and mental phenomena. And that is, of course, the hardest thing to see as non-self. But again, you can, by just understanding how the mind itself changes, the mind itself can be simplified, as, for example, you go through the various jhanas and all those kind of things, you see the impermanence of the mind, changeability of the mind, how it is constructed, how it is made up, depending on how you practice, which jhana you're in, etc. And then you can see the non-self of the mind as well. But this is pretty much way down the track, right? This is kind of when you're ready to become an arahant or something. Really, that you see this thing, so this is very profound at that particular point. But seeing the non-self of the five external senses, that is kind of within the scope of most people who are seriously practicing the path. It is not exactly easy. It is not something that happens quickly. It happens only with a lot of dedication and practice of the path, but it is kind of within the possibility of anyone who's very serious about the practice. This is like, this, you know, these are the things you can call perhaps vipassana, if you like. But again, if you do have some insight into these things, it will also make you peaceful. So peace and vipassana, again, go hand in hand. Samatha and vipassana. Okay, so that was a fairly quick one on the perception of non-self, very closely related to the perception of impermanence and also perception of dukkha. When things are non-self, you also know that they are dukkha. You throw them out. And when you throw them out, you think, whoa, so much happiness when I throw all of these things out. Wow, how nice that is, right? And if you are worried about this idea, Buddhist idea of non-self, then one of the great ways of overcoming that worry is to actually see that the less self there is inside of you, the more peaceful you are. Remember that all the thinking is really a product of the sense of self. The mind produces that. So the less you think, the less is going on inside of you, the less sense of self you have. And you think, whoa, this is just so wonderful not to have any, to have less self. So the theoretical idea, the intellectual idea of non-self can seem scary and worrying, but the experiential one, when you actually see it, it is really nice. It can be scary in experience as well, especially as you are about to abandon something, but that is not the experiential. That is not the experience of actually abandoning. The actual experience of abandoning is always positive. But it can look concerning beforehand, precisely because you are attached to these things. But notice how whenever anything fades away, wow, how nice it is, how wonderful it is. And that kind of undermines some of this sense of self inside of us. And we see how attractive that actually is. Okay. And what, Ananda, is the perception of unattractiveness? Here a bhikkhu reviews this very body upward from the soles of the feet and downward from the tips of the hair, and clothed in skin as full of many kinds of impurities. There are in this body hair of the head, hair of the body, nails, teeth, skin, flesh, sinews, bones, bone marrow, kidneys, heart, liver, pleura, spleen, lungs, intestines, mesentery, stomach, excrement, bile, phlegm, pus, blood, sweat, fat, tears, grease, saliva, snot, fluid of the joints, and urine. Thus, Thus he dwells contemplating unattractiveness in the body. This is called the perception of unattractiveness. So there you are. I don't even know what all these things are, but never mind. All these things are in there, obviously, and most of them you know about. That's what matters. So this is the purpose of this particular perception, is just to help you to overcome some of the attraction to the body. That's really the purpose of this one. It's not to become repelled by the body. It's not because you should commit suicide or anything like that. Now you may think that's a joke, but it's not actually a joke, because in the early days of the Buddha, according to one of the stories, the Buddha taught this particular meditation, the only one he taught. And then the Buddha went on retreat, and when he came out of retreat, he looked around and he said, "Whoa, the Bhikkhu Sangha is so diminished. Why is that, Ananda?" "Well, they all committed suicide because they were so fed up with their body." I don't know if that's a true story, but it's almost too amazing to have been made up. How can you make up a story like that? So it can give sense to repulsion of the body. Then you have taken it too far. You want to find that evenness where you are not really attracted to the body, nor are you kind of ready to commit suicide. That's kind of the middle way between suicide and attraction. So the idea here is to help us to move towards samadhi, right? And one of the most important things in samadhi is to be able to let go of the body, let go of the five senses. So this is the purpose here. So you review this very body. This very body means your own body. Your focus should always be on yourself. That is where the initial attraction always is. It is towards oneself. And then from attraction to oneself, from there arises the attraction towards other people. So it is. This is actually also from one of the suttas. So it is looking at oneself where the problem arises. So that's why you start with looking at yourself. You look at yourself and you look at these things, and we all know that these things are there. They're not really unattractive as such. They're not particularly attractive. They're just functions of the body. The body has to do its stuff, right? So you just kind of, but you know that these things are in there. This is part of you. You kind of feel your skeleton inside, right? People are scared of skeletons, and they actually carry one around with them at all times anyway. It's right here, right? Can't avoid that. So it's all there. So you become aware of that, and you become aware of the nature of the body. And it's much more difficult when you really feel these things inside of you. Actually, a lot of the attraction fades quite quickly when you do that. It also comes back again very quickly, so you have to kind of keep on doing it to keep it down, so to speak. This is really a very kind of monastic type of contemplation. And it may, depending on what kind of life you live as a lay person, if you live something which is very close to a monastic life, right? You're keeping, some lay people keep the 8 precepts all the time, for example. And if you live something which approaches monastic life, then these kind of contemplations may be useful. But for the majority of lay people, it probably won't work, because you are too much torn between sensual indulgence on the one hand and then unattractiveness on the other, right? If you kind of, you can't really indulge and do the unattractiveness at the same time, it just doesn't work. So you kind of, you know, sit down to meditate and attract this in the body, and then indulge in some sensual pleasures afterwards. It's going to be there is a clash there between the two, and in that clash, the sensual pleasures, the attractiveness of them, is always going to win out. It's not really going to work in that sense. So the more important thing, I think, for most lay people, but again, it really depends on how you live your lay life. You can never kind of generalize too much. The most important thing is always to deal with ill will and anger. That is the most the easiest one, but it is the most pernicious one, in the sense that it causes the most harm to yourself and to other people. So how do you do this? Well, all you do is you just see these things inside of you. You know they're there. You contemplate the fact that they're part of your body. You can do that on the walking path and kind of feel the skeleton, right? Feel the various parts of you. It's all right here, and you know it's there, and you kind of see it inside of you. And if you have any doubts, you can take out one of these charts of the body which shows you all the kind of parts inside and all that kind of stuff, if you're interested. Anyway, perception of unattractiveness. Let's move on now. And what, Ananda, is the perception of danger, the adinava sanya? The previous one, by the way, was the asubha sanya. quite well known. The perception of danger is not so well known. Adina Vasanya, here, having gone to the forest, to the foot of a tree, but to an empty hut, a bhikkhu reflects thus: its body is a source of much pain and danger, for all sorts of afflictions arise in this body. That is eye disease, disease of the inner ear, nose disease, tongue disease, body disease, head disease, disease of the external ear, mouth disease, body disease, cough, asthma, catarrh, pyrexia, fever, stomach ache, fainting, dysentery, gripes, cholera, leprosy, boils, eczema, tuberculosis, epilepsy, ringworm, itch, scab, chickenpox, scabies, hemorrhage, diabetes, hemorrhoids, cancer, fistula, illnesses originating from bile, phlegm, wind, or their combination, illnesses produced by change of climate, illnesses produced by careless behavior, illness produced by assault, or illness is produced as a result of karma, and cold, heat, hunger, thirst, defecation, and urination. Thus, he dwells contemplating danger in this body. This is called perception of danger. So here you have all the problems of the body, right? Previous one was just seeing the unattractive side. This here is seeing all other kind of problems that can arise in the body. There is a long, long list of various types of illnesses there. I must admit, I'm not sure if they were all there originally. It is quite possible that the original list only started with illnesses originating from bile, phlegm, and wind. Because this is actually apparently the ancient system in Indian medicine of how to define, how to categorize illnesses. They were categorized by how they originated, and they originated from these three things, right? Bile, phlegm, and wind. These were the three things that kind of originated illnesses. So that's really enough, and you don't really need to talk about all these other ones because they are kind of already included in that. Anyway, it is all there. One of the very interesting things about this list is that after it, in this list at the very end there, you will see it mentions eight problems of the body, right? There's eight things there in particular. There's the illnesses originating from bile, phlegm, and wind, or the combination. That's four things. Illnesses produced by change of climate. Five, illnesses produced by careless behavior. Six, illness produced by assault. Seven, and then illnesses produced as a result of karma, number eight. So these are the list of eight things. And actually, illness is not a good one there. It's really not a suitable translation. It's more like affliction, perhaps, that arise from these things. Problems, right, that arise from these things. Because not all of these things are really illnesses in the ordinary sense. They are just problems or afflictions that arise as a consequence of these things. And what is interesting about that those eight factors there is that only the last one is afflictions that produce as a result of karma, right? That is the only one. Only one that is comes from karma. All the other stuff, it just comes from what happens in life. And this is one of those very important sources in the suttas to understand properly the laws of karma and how karma actually works. This particular sequence of things is found also in a couple of other places, but it's very, very useful. And this is where you kind of can counteract some of the modern myths and ideas about how karma works. Very often you hear a very simplified idea of karma. If you are sick, it must have done something in the past, right? It must be because of my bad karma that I'm sick now. Or I just lost all my money, I must be my bad karma. They don't say anything about the fact that they go to the casino. It's because of bad karma that you lost your money, right? Or the casino, that was just a buy thing. This makes life much more sensible. If you start to look at life in general, how life actually works out, it makes good sense, right? If you are careless about things, you don't care about what you eat, or you don't have proper hygiene or whatever, of course you get sick more easily. And that is the reason why you get sick, because you've been careless, you haven't done things properly. Or sometimes it just happens by accident. If you travel to India, like we do sometimes, the chances are you will get a bit sick. At least we get some stomach upset, right? That is to be kind of expected when you go to India. So all of these things, they happen because of nature around us, because we are in this realm. It can be expected in this realm, and not necessarily because it has anything at all to do with any bad action that we did in the past. Once you are born as a human, you can expect certain things. You can expect to get sick every now and again. You can expect to be assaulted perhaps as well, right? All of these things can be expected. So these are not individual acts of karma. It's part of what it is to be a human being. You can expect these things. And that answers some of those questions that sometimes you hear about karma. You know, when you have like a big natural disaster, like a big volcano erupts and, you know, tens of thousands of people die, or 150,000 people died in that massive tsunami we had 12 years ago, whatever it was. Does it make sense that everybody in that village had the bad karma? Every single person in that village, and they all got wiped away? Does that make any sense from a karma point of view? You know, these kind of questions arise and people start thinking, this karma doesn't make any sense. But when you start to understand karma in a different way, well, actually, karma isn't everything. There are other reasons too why people die, right? Sometimes you are in the wrong place at the wrong time. The tsunami comes, and that's it. And that's what happens. If you look at one of the suttas that is often used to justify this idea that if you die young or die before it's kind of the ripe time or whatever, it is because of bad karma. One of the suttas that is used to justify that is the Chula Kamma Vibhanga Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya 135, which is the exposition of karma. And that's why it is a very famous sutta, translated into all kinds of languages from a very early time. In the comparative study of the Majjhima Nikaya done by Venerable Anālaya, that is the sutta that had the most translation into ancient languages of any sutta at all. There was 14 different versions of that sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya. There are other suttas that are even more translated, but in the Majjhima Nikaya. It's a very famous sutta. And the reason, of course, is because the message there is a very simple message about karma. If you are generous, you will become rich in the future life, right? And for simple Buddhists with very simple ideas about how to practice, it's kind of an easy message to take on board. And that's probably why it was so popular at that time. But what that sutta says, and the way it is often read, it's read as, if you die young, it means you've done a bad act. No, it doesn't say that. It says that if you have killed, then you will die young. So they reverse the causality. Instead of going from the cause, if you do kill beings, you will have short life. They say, the meaning is, if you have short life, it must mean you have killed living beings. But those are actually two different things. So if you kill lots of living beings, it will lead to short life. But you can also have short life for other reasons, right? So there's a difference there in how you look at that sutta. They have kind of reversed the sequence of things. So I don't know if that makes sense to you, what I was just saying. But anyway, it makes a big difference in how we understand karma. It means that if you die young sometimes, it is not because of bad karma. It just happens to be that way because you were at the wrong place at the wrong time. If you make very good karma, then perhaps you might be protected, right? Maybe then you will not be there when the tsunami comes for some reasons or whatever. That is also a possibility here. Anyway, so this is one of those passages in the sutra that are very important for understanding the ideas of karma. Karma is not everything. Karma really is just kind of, really, at the end of the day, it is one of the, you get reborn in the human realm, that's the main aspect of karma, and then perhaps some of the very serious illnesses you have might be a result of that. But generally speaking, karma does not have that much impact in our ordinary life. So, there you are. So you can see in that list, right? Affliction caused by careless behavior. It makes sense, right? If you're careless, you're going to have afflictions. You're going to have problems. Change in the climate, right? Maybe tsunamis can be regarded as change in the climate or something. Produced by assault, right? Even assault is not part of result of karma. Even assault is something which just happens in this life. Anyway, so it is problematic. Once you have a physical body, this is what happens to you. And this also helps you to turn away a little bit from the physical body, turn away to something else, something more peaceful, something more beautiful. This is the perception of danger, the Ardhinava Sanya. Oh, okay. Okay, so there you are. The hour has already gone, so I think we should be able to finish off the sutta tomorrow morning during the last session, so that should be fine. That's probably quite good timing right there. Okay, so that is all for this afternoon, and I'll see you again at 7:30 this evening.